Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. By now, you've likely heard the phrase, flatten the curve. The idea is to keep the spike of the numbers of COVID-19 cases from overwhelming our hospital capacity. So while we're doing the social distancing to push down that spike, public health officials are trying to raise the level of hospital capacity. What's being done about that? How is that working? What challenges are there that we still need to work out? And you can call in and tell us what you see at our hospitals and other care centers. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @TPRSource. We're joined this hour by Carrie Kroll, Vice President of Advocacy, Quality, and Public Health at the Texas Hospital Association. Carrie Kroll, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also with us, Serena Bumpus, the Practice Director for the Texas Nurses Association. Serena Bumpus, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thank you.
So, Carrie Kroll, Texas Hospital Association, what does our capacity look like right now, and what are we looking at? Are we going to be seeing a shortage of hospital beds?
Well, we're trying really hard for that not to be the case. We certainly don't have enough beds for every single Texan in our state, but we're hopeful that the mitigation activities that the governor has called for when he's asked people to stay at home, the bans that we've put on non-urgent procedures, so the surgeries that have come offline that have freed up bed space and ventilator space is helping, and the visitor policies as another example that we've put into place so that there are fewer people inside our hospitals, the ability to decrease the chance that disease will be spread. We're hoping that all of that in combination will help keep the disease from spiking in a way that, yes, that our healthcare, Texas healthcare system will be able to make sure that there are beds available for Texans. And at the same time, we're very carefully working to see what availability we have within our hospitals to bring on new beds and the things that go with them, the healthcare providers that need to provide that services, the hookups to all the gases, machines that are available. And so we're really trying to make sure that we're optimizing all kind of dark spaces within our hospitals so that we can turn on that light and help provide care to additional people.
Serena Bumpus at the Texas Nurses Association. Do we have enough nurses for what we expect?
Currently, that is something that was being looked at and considered, is what is our workforce capacity. We know that we have a certain number of ICU beds around the state of Texas, and we need to make sure that we have ICU-trained nurses to take care of those patients in those beds. Typically, ICU nurses are caring for patients at a one nurse to one patient ratio, or even a one to two patient ratio. And so when you think about how many nurses that means, we'll need, we currently don't necessarily have enough to manage that, but I know our hospitals are also looking at other resources inside their organizations. As Carrie had alluded to earlier, we've stopped all elective surgeries. So what do we do with those nurses in the surgical setting who don't currently work at their full capacity, and how can we redeploy them and train them in other areas of the hospital to help meet the need?
Carrie Kroll, so Texas is a big state, and we may not be seeing the COVID-19 crisis hitting all of the states simultaneously. We could actually see it in waves or in pockets. You know, Houston could get it at one time, and then Dallas another, or San Antonio, Austin, or wherever else. Are we going to have floating capacity? Are we able to shift things around in that way?
So those conversations are happening, and the real answer is we don't know, and we're trying to be responsive to what modeling exists and responsive to how that plays out in each community. There are certainly lessons that can be learned from neighboring states and the way that they are seeing the peak of patients coming online and what that has meant from a capacity standpoint, how they've been able to push supplies in and out. And so some of those conversations are happening on the ground now, just looking at what capacity is inside the walls of a hospital, what additional capacity could be brought on with, you know, those military type style tents, other places you don't typically think of healthcare settings, but where we could house patients once they've had COVID and they're recovering, such as a motel or hotel. And really the idea that we could then respond in some regional way where you're pushing patients from one level to another or different area of the state based on what's happening is probably going to be addressed some in real time just based on what's happening. But the concept is there, the ability to identify medical resources such as machines and beds that may be free in one area of the state while another area of the state is getting slammed. Some of that is being discussed. But there is an overwhelming need, of course, to want to make sure that we're prepared in each community and able to be respond at the same time in the event that what you see is, in fact, the state hit the peak at the same time statewide.
So if we get smart and we try to use our equipment where the need is floating around as the different waves of COVID-19 hit Texas, I imagine the Texas Hospital Association be right in the middle of trying to direct all of that, but also help me understand how hospitals are kind of set up. I mean, do we have like hospital chains, or they're like an organization that owns a hospital that's in Houston, another one, and they also own hospitals other parts of the state?
So that definitely exists. We have some large systems in our state that certainly have a representation throughout the state. But that's not the case in every community. We have a lot of individual or public hospitals that, you know, are one-stop shop in a community. In addition to their clinics, they're not in other cities throughout the state. So when we look at planning like that, it goes beyond just with the hospital association and our membership. It'll go to the partners we have at the local level through our regional advisory councils. Those have been set up over a period of time to help really coordinate the transfer of care from one level setting to another, how you work patients pre-hospital to the hospital, and then as you have a patient with a heart attack or a stroke, how you determine that from where they are picked up, that they are taken into the level of need where they that they can be treated. And that system, which has our hospital preparedness program layers on top of, is also very actively working with the Texas Department of Emergency Management right now, trying to identify what those what that partnership would look like. And so a lot of the work right now is put into determining how many beds we have as a state, what they look like from an ICU versus another type of bed, how many of them are staffed versus just beds, where we have our ventilators. All of that assessment is happening at the local level, trying to determine then what our capacity is and how best we could try and mount a response both as a state and then in those local communities. So it's a multi-tiered approach, but we're all coordinating and trying to get it right.
So I guess the first step is having an inventory of what resources we have available, what we can move around, and who controls that, and how do we get everybody to agree on chain of command, I guess, to make this happen so that the public is best covered in this time of crisis. When we come back, we'll talk about what that looks like for Bexar County and other parts of South Texas. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255 or 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. It's unfortunate that we have to even be thinking about this hospital capacity. We know that right now, we look at New York, we look at Louisiana and New Orleans, that their hospital capacity is being overwhelmed. They're setting up emergency hospitals, extra hospital beds, finding every place they can to create more room for ICU, trying to scrounge up ventilators from wherever they can find it. And the prediction is that could be happening here because the virus is in our community. We're trying to protect ourselves as much as we can by social distancing, but unfortunately for many, it's just too late. So right now we're trying to muscle up our hospitals, trying to do an evaluation, an assessment, inventory of what resources we have available, and how can we get ready for this tsunami that is going to hit us. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255, for you to join the conversation. Tanya has called in, and Tanya, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks for calling in, and go right ahead.
So I am a nurse here in Texas, and I was fired on Wednesday night for wearing a mask. Our hospital had mandated that we not wear a mask, even though adequate testing has not been being done to ensure our safety and our patient's safety. I chose to wear my mask. I was given an ADA form by my management team to fill out stating that I was disabled and that I wasn't able to care for my patients appropriately. I refused to sign that, and the following night I was fired. This hospital has since changed their policy to allow the nurses to bring in their own masks from home, but all of our PPE except for gloves has been locked up from us, not even able to get to. They've also changed all of the precautions that we normally would have in place for patients, such as neutropenic precautions. We're no longer gowning, gloving, or masking for them. C. diff precautions, all of those normal precautions that we normally would take to protect our patients are no more. I'm hearing from nurses all across the United States that this is happening, that we're using our masks until they literally fall apart. How is that being addressed?
All right, Tanya, thank you so much for calling in. I, too, have heard this. I've heard it from relatives, and I've seen social messaging that follows right along what Tanya just told us. So it sounds true to me. So first, let me go to Serena Bumpus, Practice Director for the Texas Nurses Association. Your reaction.
Hi, Tanya. First, I want to say and offer my condolences to you. I am so sorry that that was your experience. Definitely not what we want to see happen to our nurses, especially when we need them now more than ever. I do know across the country, our hospitals are preserving their resources, and the CDC has recommended that our facilities reuse their personal protective equipment as much as possible. I have heard several reports of other nurses, unfortunately, being terminated due to the fact that they've chosen to wear their own masks inside their facilities, which is very unfortunate because we need to be working together now more than ever. Some organizations have gone to a policy that allows nurses to wear a mask throughout their entire shift. They have to label the mask and date it. And at the end of the shift, they place that mask inside a paper bag, and it's kept inside the unit that they're working on. And then they come back the next day for their second shift during the week, and they get a second mask, and it's dated and labeled. This is a process that seems to work fairly well. It gives the nurses the peace of mind that they need to protect themselves and to protect their patients. I have advised other nurses who have called me to discuss this very issue to go back and have that conversation with their leadership inside their hospital to see if that's an option for to help give everyone the peace of mind that they need and to be able to care for their patients appropriately. No one should feel like they're being retaliated against because they're choosing to protect themselves.
Carrie Kroll with the Texas Hospital Association, what's your reaction to Tanya's response?
Well, I mean, I think it's entirely unacceptable that we're having to put people or that people are being put in the place on the front lines without the protective gear that they need to do their job. And while I can't speak to Tanya's circumstances in specific, right, I don't know all of the details. I know that it's alarming for her, and I hate that she's in that situation. What I would say is that as an industry, the hospitals have been working, day and night to try and get more and more information and visibility on this protective gear that we've asked for. In fact, earlier this week, THA, in coordination with TNA,
submitted a letter to the governor just saying, we appreciate all the leadership you've provided on this in this area, but you came to us from a warehouse and said, we've got all these supplies coming. The sooner we know what they look like and when we can get them out to the front lines, the better. And I think the issue there has been that the shortages are real. We had them before this crisis started. We had a heavier than normal influenza season throughout our state, throughout the nation. And the supply lines out of China have made it so that, we're the perfect storm now. And that is daunting for our frontline staff to feel like they have the ability to protect themselves before they're able to protect our patients. And so we are doing our best in constant communication with the governor's office, the state health department, and our locals to make sure that our hospitals, as they need supplies, they're coming online. And I can guarantee you that there's not a hospital in the state that doesn't have some level of need when it comes to protective gear. And it is unfortunate that it leaves, the people that we're asking upon to treat this, this deadly virus to do so in a place where they don't feel fully protected.
So Tanya, are you still there? Tanya?
Yes, I am.
So I'm sorry you got fired, and these two other high-ranking individuals in this healthcare system, they see what you're seeing, and they're saying, well, this is what we're dealing with. It seems like, don't you think that we should have had more face masks available? The fact that we have to ration them even now before it's really gotten this bad? I mean, how did you think we got here?
I'm really not sure how we got here. So the government has been supplying funds to hospitals since 2002 for emergency disaster preparedness. I'm not sure where those funds have gone since hospitals have been required to have in stock so that we can face a disaster like this. Also, I have questions. You're telling us to put our masks into a paper bag after they've already been contaminated. That paper bag then is contaminated. So therefore, you're asking your frontline nurses, doctors, and everyone else to then reuse a mask that's been contaminated. We're reusing these masks from room to room to room. They are not just being used for one patient at this point. My second point is also, what about this China supply? Why are we getting our resources from China? We are America. We are supposed to be better than this. We are supposed to be able to provide our own PPE. Why are we relying on another nation to provide our PPE for us?
Okay, so that last question our guest cannot answer because that's a high-ranking government, federal-type question. But Carrie Kroll, Texas Hospital Association, it does make sense that if you're going to put your mask into a paper bag and the next day it's just going to be foul, isn't it?
Right. So, I don't think that there's any infection control people out there that believe we're working underneath the optimal circumstances. But the truth of the matter is that the Centers for Disease Control is working daily to put out new guidance as they see that they can to keep our frontline and staff safe, right? And that's why you've seen their guidance has shifted over time related to PPE, and that's been in large response to the shortages and what they know needs to be done from a safety reuse perspective. It's not ideal, and I think that the fact of the matter is that we're in the middle of a pandemic. It hasn't, as much as we plan and prepare for, we've been caught in certain areas, supply chain being one of them, unprepared. And so we really do want to be as responsive as possible. And I think they're handing down this guidance that indicates that reuse of a mask in certain circumstances or by a cohort of patients, you use one person, one mask in one area is what they're recommending at the moment. And we just continue to try and push the most available information from the disease experts as we can. And hope that these efforts that are being made, the governor has pulled someone off of their normal job at Dell to put him in charge of procuring. And we just hope that those supply lines become available in a way where we can just put those materials in the hands of the people that need it. And I will also say that I'm hearing things from throughout the state of new, our engineers and scientists and other people trying to figure out ways of taking the masks that are being used and cleaning them in a way so they're acceptable to go back out into use. And there's a lot happening on the ground. I think the frustrating part is for everyone, patients and practitioners alike, is that it's slow, and we have a disease that's in front of us that we have to take care of now.
And Carrie Kroll, the issue that hospitals were being given funding for disaster prep, did that happen? And why wasn't stocking up for these necessary items part of that plan?
Sure. And it's not, the system is a little bit complicated, and we certainly don't want to get into all those details right now. But the hospital preparedness program was created sort of post 9/11 to focus on how to make sure that hospitals could prepare to the next disaster, disease, whatever that's ahead of them. And if you go and look at those numbers out of Congress, because it's a federally program that comes to the states, those have, diminished over time. And that's what happens in our country, right?
We take our eye off the ball.
That's right. And over time, it's just not as big of a priority. And I will say that as someone who's worked in public health for many, many years, it's not the sexiest issue. People don't want to talk about the things that keep you safe from a health perspective. It's much more fun to talk about some other glitzy issues. And so those numbers have drifted. We've been able to do a good amount of good things by pooling the money in the communities and buying a lot of resources, such as you see when we have an explosion in the plant in West, the big ambulance type trucks we're able to put there, the big, those sorts of pieces of machinery have been put online with those grant dollars when they were coming in. Now they've been more lean, and there's less that hospitals have been able to do to prepare for that. And so some of that is more of an infrastructure. When you're talking about, stockpiles of things and ventilators on hold, all of that just hasn't been a focus of those dollars because it hasn't thought to be, scientifically appropriate, the best way to do that, to lock those things up. And so there's probably a good amount of reflection that's going to come, as does after any sort of event, where we look at programs and what they should be funded at and what they should be, putting money towards and how we can be prepared for the next time something like this attacks us.
But right now we're in the middle of the beginning of a historic event like the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. We're trying to figure out how to get through this now. And with this, is this shortage of PPE going to continue as you see it, Carrie? And we're going to have to deal with these sort of stopgap measures that are less than ideal.
Yeah, I don't see anything that is promising enough that shows us there are new numbers of supplies coming online. I know that everyone around the state is working really hard, including the individuals at the state level. The governor has pinpointed to do this. But for every, box of 10 million masks that we can buy for $6 each mask, they pick up the phone. They call those people, and most of it's been fraudulent, sadly, and there's just not a lot of inventory there. So, we continue to push for it, and it continues to be the right thing to do, and we'll continue to work on it. There's no guarantee that we're going to have the adequate supply we need. We'll certainly have supplies. Whether or not it'll be what we need is another question.
All right, we're taking another break. Our phone lines are open if you want to join our conversation as we talk about hospital preparedness, hospital capacity. We're going to change focus to looking at what's happening here locally in the South Texas area. We're joined by Eric Epley, the Executive Director of the Southwest Texas Regional Advisory Council. And you can call in 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. The Source continues after this break.
All of us are affected by the coronavirus pandemic. All of us. Please, if you're able, support the people and organizations that need your help. Food banks, homeless shelters, restaurants. The need is endless. And if you can, support the real, reliable journalism that keeps you informed with the facts about COVID-19 and the stories of the people impacted by it. We're here for you because of you. Visit TPR.org today, and thanks.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about hospital capacity. This is something that communities right now are focused on with a lot of intensity. Governor Greg Abbott has identified at least 16,000 beds available for COVID-19 patients around the state. And he has announced that a makeshift hospital is being set up now in Dallas. We're also talking about using the Joe Freeman Coliseum in San Antonio as a spill oversight. There is a frantic need right now to try to create as much space, look at what's going to be coming our way, and prepare for this because lives will depend on it. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. Joining us now, Eric Epley, Executive Director of the Southwest Texas Regional Advisory Council, STRAC. He is at the tip of the spear coordinating hospitals in the South Texas area. And Eric, give us an assessment of where we are right now.
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back with you. So right now we're working feverishly, both at the hospital level and at the emergency management level. I'm today at the Emergency Operations Center here, working with my colleagues from the Regional Medical Operations Center and Public Health as well. And so we're working right now. We have adequate, capability. I wouldn't say it's perfect, but it's definitely adequate, and mainly in large reason because of what the mayor and the judge have done here locally, but taking the prudent steps to decrease social, put social distancing in place and the stay-at-home order and those things is definitely having the kind of positive effect we want. You know, we talked last time about flattening the curve. We believe that's happening. And we're excited to see those interventions working effectively for our community. We just need to keep doing those really basic steps, washing our hands, limiting social interaction as best we can and staying at home. On the hospital front, we're opening new areas. We're doing training for nurses for non-traditional roles they may have had. So some hospitals are consolidating labor and delivery, for instance. So if you have that labor and delivery in 3 or 4 year hospitals, can you do that in one location and free up those, number one, those areas, but also those nurses and do some additional training for some of the critical care, ventilator responsibilities and things they may have here in the near future? The surge, the question about when the surge will start, and, everybody's watching the models on TV and looking at the internet. And, I think when that curve starts, we just want that to be as slow a start as it can be, and that we don't do a big spiked peak. We do a nice, easy rolling hill like in the hill country.
All right. I'm going to play a voicemail that we got from Brad.
My name is Brad. I'm a registered nurse. I live in Schertz, Texas. The question I have is people talk about the shortage of ICU beds and respirators and ventilators. And the people who mainly work with people that are vented are respiratory therapists. How long does it take to train somebody up to be competent in all the skills required to be an RT? And will there be any effort made to, fast-track people, say, if I'm already a physical therapist or an occupational therapist or an LPN or RN, and I want to help out with the epidemic pandemic management, should there be any effort made to fast track and give people a quickie lesson to bring them up to speed? Because I'm concerned that we won't have enough qualified respiratory therapists, even if we do get the number required number of ICU beds and ventilators.
Let me go to Serena Bumpus on that, practice director for the Texas Nurses Association. Can we quickly ramp up the number of respiratory therapists, because we know that COVID-19 is a respiratory disease. It attacks the lungs. We need people who are able to be able to administer aid and medical care in this area. Do we have enough respiratory therapists, and can we create more quickly?
You know, Dave, I don't know that is anything we've really taken a heavy look at. Workforce is still something that
we are trying to research as at the state level and understand. And RTs are a critical role in making sure that we're able to care for our patients effectively. That's definitely a great question. And most of our respiratory therapists have bachelor's degrees and go through 4 years of training to be able to practice in our hospitals, in our community. And so that's I think, something that we need to take a deeper look into.
And Carrie, Eric, either of you have a solid answer. If not, we'll move on.
So I think one of the ways we're addressing that at the actual, I would call it the boots on the ground perspective, is our crisis standards of care process. We have a work group that's made up of physicians and nurses and other leaders, clergy, et cetera, that are working with us from each healthcare system, and we meet every other day. And we're working on the document that will help guide us with respect to crisis standards of care. And one of those things is who else can help operate, in those patient care environments that's a non-traditional role for them. The whole idea around crisis standards of care is that you end up doing things that you wouldn't normally do. I would bet that most RTs have never had a bunch of discussion about putting, two or even four ventilated patients on one ventilator. But there are YouTube videos right now that were done really well in Seattle and in New York right now about the pieces of equipment, the TPs and other things to be able to do that, and how to evaluate which patients are about the same size so you can do those things. That's not normal behavior. That's not something we're used to doing. But if it keeps somebody alive and it gets them on the ventilator in a time of crisis, that's what those things are for. And certainly, the gentleman, as Brad discussed, the training other people to do those things, usually inside the building, but as it gets worse and worse, even bringing people from other walks of life, you got to do what you got to do once it gets to be weird.
Let's go to Jane on the phones. Jane, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hey. So I work with Tanya, and I just wanted to say that I was also in that same situation. My family had been sick, and it was just circling the house for like 3 weeks, and I asked if I could just wear a mask if I brought my own. And she said no, it was against policy, and it didn't change until Tanya's first podcast came out. And now we're allowed to wear masks, and someone is having them made and passing them out to us.
All right. And so how are things now? Now that you're bringing your homemade mask, how confident do you feel in those, Jane?
Yeah, some people are still a little weird about wearing them, but I think that we'll all come around. And then yesterday we got a group text that said they were going to start checking our temperatures at the door, but they've been doing that everywhere else for a while now.
All right, Jane, thank you for calling in, and good luck with you and your kids. Let me go to another caller. This is Chris. And Chris, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding the capacity or the influx that we're about to see in regards to trauma, the routine trauma that we're going to see, and we're still going to have accidents, falls, and slips and things at home. How is this going to affect us as a community, and how are you guys prepared? Are there alternative treatment sites? If these beds are to be filled as we're expecting this surge or this influx, how is that going to affect capacity? And I ask the general public. You and I have seen, we've all seen routinely, we'll hear rather, that we're already capacitated with trauma and they're sending them to other units or other facilities. How are we prepared to deal with that, with the routine trauma with the influx?
All right. Thank you for that, Chris. So Eric Epley, watch the 10 o'clock news. You still see gunshots. You still see car crashes. All those terrible things happening to people. They got to go to the hospital. If hospital capacity is swamped, what happens to those folks?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a good audience question. So what we do now, University Hospital is our lead level one trauma center, and Brooke Army Medical Center. BAMSI is the other level one trauma center. And we have other level three trauma centers in town as well. And so load balancing our capacity issues around our trauma volume is critical. And it's not just trauma, right? People are going to have heart attacks. They're going to have STEMIs, these critical heart attacks that have to go straight to the cath lab. And so there's non-COVID capability and capacity issues we're load balancing as well. Of note, BAMC and University, and for those listeners who have been around long enough to remember Wilford Hall back in the day when we had three level one trauma centers, we've had a standing agreement with our level one trauma centers for better than 20 years that allows them to move surgeons and other team members back and forth if in a critical situation we would need to. The capability and capacity at BAMC could easily manage all. We'd have to move people. We need to move surgeons and the anesthesiologists, other people to help. But we've looked at this critically before, and I'll tell you, we've actually activated this contingency plan, but they've usually been because the military needed to go to war, the first Gulf War, and then, of course, with Afghanistan, some of the other things, for a temporary time for maybe 3-4 months. Both Wilford Hall and BAMC at the time went on diversion completely to trauma, and University took that that load. In this case, if we have a bunch of COVID patients in the civilian sector and they were at University, we can activate that plan if needed. It's pretty far down in the contingency planning algorithm, I'll tell you, but I want our listeners to know that that's a capability. San Antonio has had a plan with our regional trauma system for years.
And quickly, Eric Epley, I'm getting ready to go to break, but wanted to ask you this quick question. Was there a stockpile of the protective equipment in San Antonio for the South Texas?
We've had a stockpile since H1N1. Some of it was going bad. All that stuff expires, right? And so some of it has been useful, a very small amount. But for the most part, we've been having to exchange that out as it's expired over the years. For the past several, probably 4 years, we've been getting rid of it as it expired.
So are we hanging on to it, waiting for the worst of the cases, or has it been distributed?
Now we're receiving the Strategic National Stockpile and other PPE from the Texas Division of Emergency Management. So those loads are coming in, and we've got that on hand. So that's here in our town now.
So the supply chain is coming in. Maybe we'll take care of some of this need that we're hearing about. Taking another break. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We do have some breaking news related to our topic, coronavirus and hospital capacity. Texas Health and Human Services is now reporting 3,997 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and 58 fatalities in Texas. And so we have 207 confirmed cases here in Bexar County, and is up statewide, up from 3,200 yesterday. That is now 3,997. Also, we're hearing that the city of San Antonio is reporting that there is a COVID-19 outbreak at a local nursing home. We're going to have more information on that as it becomes available. So first, let me go to Carrie Kroll, Vice President of Advocacy, Quality, and Public Health at the Texas Hospital Association. I'm sure you're getting reports like this all of the time. New numbers. Every number is a scary number. And you have to be thinking, It just continues to get worse, and you have been working very diligently to get the hospitals ready for it. How confident are you about the capacity?
The capacity issues are going to be trying, but all of the effort that goes on behind the scenes, really daily in hospitals and their preparedness role. I mean, they do exercises regularly to prepare for infectious disease. It's certainly different to train for it and to respond to it, but we are hopeful that all that effort certainly will play out. And, the answer is that we're, prepared and ready to do it. The beds, when we may not have a bed for every single person in Texas, we certainly have a plan to make sure we can get on top of that capacity, both inside the hospital and in the ways that Eric has spoken to outside of the hospital. And it just goes to speak to the need for people to continue to practicing their social mitigation strategies. We know that not every Texan is taking that seriously. We hope the governor's announcement yesterday really resonates with them, and they realize that the quicker they start, taking personal responsibility, staying indoors,
it will help curb the rise of the disease and make it easier for the healthcare system as a whole to deal with capacity as these cases continue to increase.
But even as the governor is urging people to stay home, he is lifting up local bans on gatherings for church services. That seems to be sending a conflicting message. Let me go to Rick on the phones. Rick, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Yeah, just a quick suggestion for cleaning up the face mask, sanitizing the face mask. I'm a lifelong healthcare worker, and one of the things I do and I find is effective is to use either isopropyl alcohol, rubbing alcohol, or ethanol, drinking alcohol, at least 60%, to sanitize, soak the used mask, let them dry out, and then they're fairly safe to reuse.
All right, so if you didn't hear that, Rick is talking about using rubbing alcohol to clean out a mask after it has been used, sanitize it or soap and water, other things that can be done in order to sterilize or clean. I don't know if it's going to be sterilized or sanitized, but it'd be cleaner than it was. Eric Epley at the Southwest Texas Regional Advisory Council, are you asking people to do things like that?
So the homemade, what they people typically call the homemade masks, there's an effort underway right now with I call them a tiger team. They're on it. They're working on it. They're calling it the textile filtration mask. And so it's being constructed out of tightly woven cotton. And we've got some people who are textile experts. We've got some architects. We've got some engineers. We got, it's probably a team of about 15 or 20 people that have been working on this as a project for the past maybe 10 days, and they've even got a filter, I forget what the name of the filter is, but it's like a charcoal activated filter that can be inserted. It's a two-ply mask, and they've been working with some of the big folks in town that do mass clothing things to be able to produce these in case we're going to need them. And they're working with Southwest Research Institute. This is the kind of thing you don't hear much about, and it'll make you proud to be an American, that you hear teams of people who are quarantined at home or that they're doing the stay-at-home order start thinking innovatively, and they've been working, I call it working feverishly, although it's not really the best word, And they've now been working with Southwest Research Institute to measure. They're actually going to evaluate the mask for its effectiveness as compared to a standard simple face mask or even an N95. And so based on that data, when they get that back, there'll be more about this. But being able to produce it in mass basically in the thousands a day in the San Antonio area would be a godsend if we really do get super critically low on PPE.
Yeah, you're right. That does make me proud to be an American. But also what would have made me proud to be an American is to have officials leading the government who weren't screwing around and joking about this and not taking this seriously and dealing with this in a way that we wouldn't have to be sewing these things with fabric scraps. Let me play a voicemail here.
Yes, I would like to know why hospitals don't provide uniforms cleaning or places where uniforms can be left and washed instead of taking home their bugs to the families.
Okay, so let me go to Serena Bumpus, practice director for the Texas Nurses Association. So when the nurses go home, are they wearing the stuff that they've been wearing all day long at the hospital, or do they change out, or is there some sort of cleaning process? What goes on there?
So we have provided some education to nurses across the state on how they can prevent taking some of those bugs home. And, you know, one of the things that one of the suggestions we've offered is if they're able at their organization, if their shower facility's there, to bring a change of clothes with them and shower at the hospital, place their clothes in a plastic bag, and they should keep a separate pair of shoes dedicated just to work as well. But then they can bring those clothes home, immediately take them to the washer and wash them on the hottest setting
allowed. We know that there's a big concern from nurses across the state about having that opportunity to transition from work to home without bringing anything back. And if they're not able, their facility lacks the ability for changing and showering, then they need to create a hot zone in their home. And that zone should be somewhere outside of the home where they can remove their scrubs before entering the living space, place their scrubs in an impervious container like a plastic bag, and then that way they don't walk through their home with their scrubs that they wore during their shift. Make sure that they're handling them appropriately and washing their hands afterwards. The same thing goes for their shoes, making sure that they're keeping their shoes in a plastic tote to prevent them from touching anything. Leave them at work if at all possible. And then take at home, identifying an area where they themselves can self-quarantine if they have been exposed to COVID-19 or plan to interact with anyone after caring for those patients so they can minimize the risk with their family as well.
Right. Hopefully those nurses don't have to take public transportation to get home to do that. Carrie Kroll, a really quick question with the Texas Hospital Association. I saw that Governor Abbott, in one of his executive orders, said that he was going to lift some of the regulations allowing some closed hospitals to reopen. Do you know of any hospitals that have done that?
Not that are active now, but we know that our partners with the National Guard, Army Corps of Engineers, are assessing those facilities now to see whether or not they can be quickly brought online, or if the infrastructure is such, which it really, that it won't be responsive enough to be able to bring it online in a short amount of time. So there are areas of the state, especially in our rural communities.
Yeah, the rural ones. That's what I'm worried about.
Significant amount of them going offline.
And Texas has lost more rural hospitals than any other state over the last 10 years. I'm going to go to Randy, and this is my last question. Randy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Say, in San Antonio, KCI is a big business, and in the past they did kinetic therapy beds, and they were for specifically the intervention in pneumonia. Are these available in the hospitals?
So KCI Kinetic Concepts Incorporated, they came up with hospital beds that were able to deal with bed sores and other medical equipment. And so, Eric Epley, are we able to tap into the resources of KCI?
Yep. Every hospital has connections with KCI and has used those beds and used them regularly. And those are certainly on the list of things we'll be dealing with. They also make other beds that are There's lots of material the hospitals get from durable medical equipment people every day that, you have beds for morbidly obese people. They're big, big beds, and they may not have enough of those on any given day, and so they'll order those up really quickly, and those are on just-in-time kind of a thing. So all those things are available to the hospitals for this crisis.
But KCI used to be based in San Antonio, and I know they were sold, but so are they no longer based here? Do you know?
I don't know.
Yeah, so we may not have that local hookup that we used to have on Dr. Leiniger is no longer running the show there. So I got an email from Kathy saying that there are mask shortages at her hospital. She's found instructions online. She's got a lot of fabric scraps. She started making them. She knows they're not certified, but how can she get them to some place where people can actually use them? And so, Carrie Kroll, the Texas Hospital Association, do you just take them to the local hospital, or what do you do?
Well, we're encouraging people to do two things. One is the Texas.gov website. It's been put up specifically for the voluntary donation of items. The state will have a hand in distributing those to areas of need. And then we also at THA are offering that as a resource to our members.
Carrie Kroll is the Vice President of Advocacy at the Texas Hospital Association. Serena Bumpus at the Texas Nurses Association. Eric Epley is with the Executive Director of the Southwest Texas Regional Advisory Council. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.